Hi, this is Dr. Mike Barnes, and I'd like to welcome you to the third episode of Beyond Addiction and Trauma, the Family Recovery Podcast. This week, my guest is Steve Millett. He's the founder and CEO of Climb LLC, which is an impact services consulting organization. He also works with LifeLab Studios, a technology company associated with Arizona State University that I worked with when building the Michael Barnes Family Institute app. The app is actually a key part of our virtual family program for families struggling with a loved one's addiction and trauma. More importantly, Steve's really an old friend. He and I worked together when he was the executive director and I was the clinical director at an addiction treatment center called Cedar. Cedar was part is part of the University of Colorado Health System and also the University of Colorado Medical School. Today, we're going to be talking about best practices, various kind of programming and technological advances for virtual coaching, education, and support in programs designed for families who are struggling with a loved one's addiction and trauma. And so it should be an interesting discussion. We work together on best practices for this on a regular basis. You can listen to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, and you can watch the podcast on my YouTube channel, which is at Michael Barnes, PhD, LAC, LPC. I also want to remind you of my book. It's called When the Solution Becomes the Problem, Helping Families Struggling with Addiction and Trauma. You can purchase a paperback version or ebook version at my website, drmikebarnes.com. And that's drmikebarnes.com. So thanks a lot. Appreciate it. And have a great day and have a great listen. Thanks. Greetings, everyone. My guest today is Steve Millett. He's an old friend. We've known each other for about 12 years. We've worked together. We worked together at the Center for Dependency, Addiction, and Rehabilitation, better known as CDER, at the University of Colorado Health. Steve was the executive director. I was the clinical director, and I've invited Steve because he was a really early adapter, and the kind of technology, clinical technology, and there seems to be such a divide these days between what's better, in person or what's better, virtual. Has the technology caught up to in person yet? And those kinds of things. And I have my opinions, and this the expert that I go to and I trust, and he and I have worked together on the creation of an app for our family program, and so. Lots of information to share. Welcome, Steve. Great to see you.
Thanks, Mike. It's great to be here.
Yeah, this will be fun. I appreciate
Yeah,
it.
we'll be.
Appreciate it. So can you give the listeners a little rundown on your experience? I know you've worked at big, really, really good treatment centers and now really important technology companies. Fill everybody in on who you are and what you do.
Yeah, for sure. I started as a clinician, so I think everyone needs to know that. So I have that sort of lens of clinical first, which, started as a licensed mental health counselor in Florida. Actually, I started in the field before I had my master's degree and got licensed. So I was providing family programming and working with adolescents and families before I even got licensed and certified. So I started my career in Florida in the late 80s and worked in addiction and mental health my whole career. My last position in Florida was with the Hanley Hazelden Center, better known as the Hazelden Betty Ford Clinic. They've since opened another program in Florida and they're not affiliated with the Hanley Center any longer. So they have a program in Naples, Florida, that they opened up about 5 years afterwards. Then I went to Pavilion, which is in North Carolina, and I was director of clinical services there. And I was there for about 8 years before I came to Colorado to take this job at Cedar and the Behavioral Health Service Line of UCH, which Cedar's a part of. That's University of Colorado Hospital. And it was there that I got introduced to Scott Beck and to the GLUE organization in Boulder, and became enamored with platform technologies and how technology can help the behavioral health industry in particular, solve a lot of the problems that plagued us from early on. So, yeah, that's a little bit of my history. And I've been with GLUE and now have my own consulting company. And we're going to talk a little bit about LifeLab Studios today, or a lot about LifeLab Studios today and their platform, and how that technology is helping the Mike Barnes Family Institute.
Wow, it's been remarkable. And I remember when you got really hot on technology and you were bringing these ideas in, and we were all going, wow, this. And I remember seeing GLUE for the first time, the platform, and thinking, this is remarkable. It literally was remarkable. And begin to picture how there's certain parts of the population that's all they do is on their phones, and they're so comfortable with it. And one of the things at some point in this conversation, I would love for you to talk a little bit about is like what we have found since we have adopted the app is that there are certain, and it's mostly parents and grandparents, maybe a little bit older, that are not really good in technology. But it's amazing how quickly they pick it up. And the next thing you know, they're scooting around that app pretty quickly. And, but to talk a little bit about what is the best way for people who are a little reticent for technology, or a little fearful might be the right word, technology, to be able to recognize that it's actually pretty easy.
Yeah, and it's getting easier every day. That's one of the things that I love about technology, that it constantly evolves, and it's really designed to any technology for that matter, is really designed to help make our lives easier. And if it doesn't make it easier, then it's not going to be adopted. And it needs to solve certain problems. And so some of the key problems that I was really interested in addressing at Cedar, since it was an academic institution and it was an academic medical campus framework, we did a lot of experimentation. And technology was one of the ones that we did. And we did a lot of research, and we did a lot of training of people in different professions as they came along. And so I was really happy. It kind of started in my later days in Florida with the interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary approach to treatment. So we had psychiatrists and psychologists and licensed professional counselors and peer recovery coaches and chaplains and nurses all providing care. It's kind of the Mayo model of approach to solving some of the behavioral health problems that we were facing. And I see technology as just another member of the team. And all members of the team utilize technology in one form or fashion. And so think of the electronic, medical record, the EMR or the EHR now. And it is ubiquitous now. When I started, we
Oh, yeah.
were still doing things on paper, with paper and pencil, and keeping 3-ring binders for charts. And so every organization that I was lucky enough to be involved with had a major technology change happening when I joined them. At Cedar, for example, we were transitioning from paper to the Epic EMR system. And that was a hospital-wide initiative, but at Cedar, we were still paper and pencil, which hard to believe in 2011, 2012, that was the case, but it was. And there were a lot of obstacles. But that's the thing that technology can help provide, is the ease of use. And so when we think about bringing that to the consumer, to the patient, or to the family member, we think about their experience. of the technology? How do they experience it, both from an ease of use perspective, as well as what they encounter when they do use it? And so, at Cedar, we did a lot of work on making the family program more interactive and really focused on a couple of things. One, that the family member was in need of recovery. That's a sort of a systems approach. And two, that they needed to be engaged for themselves. Now, that helped their loved one who was in treatment, but it wasn't the primary purpose of the family program. It was really to help instantiate recovery among the members of the family who participated, and maybe broader if they brought that message out to the extended family. And so, how we use technology to start with at Cedar was with our alumni program, and it wasn't with the family program. It wasn't until, a few years ago that you and I started talking about how do we use this technology to help family members access care, access evidence-based practices, access a systems model, a systems approach to care. And how do we instantiate that on the platform in such a way that they can access it anytime, anywhere, and also be supported and create support systems that their loved one was experiencing by going through the program?
It's interesting. I think it was 2017 was the first time it dawned on me that there's a problem in family program. And it's while we were at Cedar. And I set out to do, I did a survey with every family member who came into the program and did a whole demographic study and found that the average family member who attended was a mom or a dad, and who was not attending were partners and husbands and wives, because they were busy taking care of kids and they were busy with their jobs. And that was really, for me, the beginning of the thought that we've got to figure something out to make it more accessible. And I think, to me, that's the greatest shift and or the greatest opportunity is access, and that people can do it from anywhere. Think about it. When we came into the field, I came in a little bit before you, but not a whole lot before you. There was no such thing as virtual anything. There was in-person treatment, in-person family, in-person everything. And I've been speaking at conferences recently about the idea that people really hold on to this idea that in-person is better. I think in some ways it might be, and in other ways I'm not so sure about that. But particularly if I can't get there, then it's probably not better for many of us. And so, I thought maybe since you've been a director at so many different places, like at the various places you've been, what has been the philosophy of family programming? This is for our listeners who are family members struggling with a loved one's addiction and trauma, to understand that there really hasn't been any one particular way of doing this, but people have really, really concrete beliefs about which is the best ones about that. And sometimes that's helpful, sometimes that's not helpful. And I was just curious, what have you seen in the course of a career to understand the traditional and now evolving patterns that how is it different?
Well, we've had the idea of the identified patient for a long time, and that's a family systems approach. Like, this is the person in treatment is the identified patient. They're the person that we need to intervene on. They're the person who gets the evidence-based practices at the time. And a systems approach is really about providing a treatment of the whole family or whoever's able and willing to participate in the system to solve the problem. I think that's I ascribe personally to that methodology. I think most traditional treatment programs, though still In fact, some of our privacy and confidentiality requirements, regulations focus on that as the primary, subject. So they think about the identified patient's rights when they think about privacy and security. And the HIPAA is based on that, and the 42 CFR regulations are based on that. And so I very much took and still ascribe to a systems model. But traditionally, family programs were provided for members of the family for a couple of reasons. Organizations saw the value of that in keeping the patient, the identified patient, in treatment. So they saw the importance of completing treatment and engagement with a longer term process as important for the outcomes. And traditional treatment focused on the family member as an ally in that process. And so they would involve them for that purpose. And if they got education, if they got into their own recovery, that was great. And a lot of times that was the format for their engagement, but the motive wasn't that. The motive was create an ally for us to work better with the identified patient. And then accrediting organizations like the Joint Commission got on the bandwagon and started requiring family programming, family interventions of some kind, because they saw it as a family illness. And we've had, substance use disorders ha traditionally have been seen as a family issue. And so incorporating the family member to achieve better outcomes was also a motivation, but it was a secondary motivation to keeping the patient in treatment or to keeping the patient engaged in the process for as long as possible. And right up until, fairly recently in the last decade, that's still the modus operandi for most treatment programs, is to, include and involve the family members for that purpose. They don't get paid for it. In our payment models, families are very seldom paid for unless there's a family therapy component and that it gets billed for. Most treatment programs aren't designed to kind of deliver that. And most family programs are psychoeducational based and group based, and they're folded into the cost of care, as opposed to billed separately. So, kind of traditionally, that's been the approach until fairly recently. Now it's more and more the place where if you think about how patients get into treatment, it's primarily the family member that calls. The spouse or the parent or the loved one calls for them, does all the research for them, maybe plans an intervention for them. And the family's often the first to be involved. And as soon as the patient comes in, they're kind of relegated to a second class citizen. That's kind of still prevalent in our field.
That's really interesting how that does work, and that if the client, the identified patient in the family, chooses not to sign releases to allow family to participate, then by talking to the family about their loved one's treatment, we're violating their confidentiality. And
So
so
how do we get around that at Cedar? Or how do we address that at Cedar?
well, one of the things that we had said was that if family was involved, and I've always said this, if family was involved before the client got here, that we have a relationship with that family. And then I would tell clients, look, your family can come to family programming because we already know them. And that you'll never see them because you haven't signed a release. We would want to keep you out of their site because we don't want to violate your confidentiality. But So if we had a relationship with the family before the admission, then we've already educated them on family programming and that this is what's going to happen. And so that's really the idea that we're not going to talk about you, we're going to talk about recovery and what recovery looks like. And so that's, and Foundry is the same way, where, at NRG, where I am now, that's, we do the same thing. The family was there before. The families need to understand that if they were not part of that admission process and the client, their loved one that won't sign those releases, we really can't do much with them.
Yeah, it's a struggle, and it's an important thing to involve the family, because, like I said, they're instrumental in the success. A family that's in recovery is a lot harder for an identified patient to continue their old ways within, and a family that's in recovery is a healthier family. They're a more functional family. They have skills and abilities. They're no longer as prone to be at the mercy of the identified patient. And they end up having a much better life, regardless of what happens. Now, chances are it's more likely that the identified patient is going to also be in recovery if they see other family members following the same path.
Yeah, it's really interesting. The research, I mean, I'm very focused on chronic disease management, and we tell families that it's chronic progressive, potentially fatal family disease, but we don't really treat it as such most of the time. And so we've gone really to the kind of other side of that. It says that if you follow the research, it's very clear. Individuals with a chronic illness manage their illness better when they and their family come to an agreement about what they're trying to deal with. And that while the loved one has the illness, that illness has impacted every member of that family over the course of time, kind of leading up to the diagnosis. And that the same goes for when families begin to look not at time, but as in recovery is going to be a part of our lives forever. When is this treatment over? Well, we want to get back to normal. Well, the normal ship sailed a long time ago in most families. And then the last one is when family members begin to talk to their loved ones about, this is what I'm learning about recovery, and this is the recovery I need to do. It really changes the dynamic from this sort of one-up position that families maintain when the client is the identified patient to old position that says, I'm just as much in recovery as you are at this point. But that's really when chronic disease management is its most effective. So that, in my mind, is the biggest shift that we can not impose, but implement in family programming, that education.
Yeah, I loved your book, When the Solution Becomes the Problem, because it really describes that at the level of the family member. And in ways that they can really engage with and understand and apply to their own lives. And the fact that the program that you've designed is really around a chronic disease management model for families, it's a pretty remarkable thing that you've created. And to now also make that available on the platform is amazing. It integrates a lot of the things that I think technology can and should be used for. So there's a right use of technology, there's a right use of data to facilitate closure of some of the gaps that exist in the behavioral health world. And one of those is creating access. So I think there's two kinds of access. There's the convenience factor. There's the ability for a family member who wants to participate but just can't leave work on time or can't take a week off work, or for whatever reason is not able to make the in-person work for them. in their life. And so they have a couple of choices. They can do research on their own and educate themselves, and or they can risk other important areas of their lives to be in person. So you open up access and engagement there. But you also open up an engagement for the long term. So you talked about a chronic approach. And so family members can stay on for up to a year on the platform and participate as they get into recovery, as they experience their own results. They can, pass that on to other group members who are relatively new. And it's really kind of remarkable how much they do stay on and participate both on the platform and in synchronous virtual support groups.
That's been one of the great surprises for us is when we were just talking about the anniversary for the launch of the app is in 2 weeks, I think. Middle of June. And we were looking at some of the people who signed on at the beginning, and most of them were still active on the app today. And that surprised us. We really thought once they went through it, but they're in there participating, giving other families feedback. Which is just we couldn't ask for it to be better than that. And so it really is amazing. So let's talk about that. Well, again, there are clearly strengths in person and getting to know a mentor and those kinds of things and having a curriculum to, you're going to go through a bunch of handouts and you're going to go through this curriculum, a little bit of experiential work to kind of challenge your belief systems. Getting to know other families. Can you speak to the strengths of the virtual process?
Yeah, I'll start with a little background on LifeLab Studios, which is the maker of the Journey.do platform that you're referring to. And I've been involved with Sasha, who's the founder of the company, for over a decade now. And Scott Beck, who I talked about founding Glue, is on their board. And so I've been following Sasha, who's a learning scientist at ASU. He and his wife, Anna Ricci, who's also a learning scientist, helped found this company and did a lot of research. So I've been tracking with them for the past decade or so, but I've worked with them in the last couple of years and more earnestly in the last year to get their platform, which was originally designed to bring learning science and the technology world together, primarily using immersive technology and gamification to help classroom learners. And so you'll hear us refer a lot to learners as the identified patient or the person going through the program, receiving the curriculum or getting the coaching or whatever it might be. We'll refer to them as learners. We'll refer to the champ, to the coaches or the clinicians or whoever as the champions, and there's a champion dashboard side. And so they've developed this platform to, with learning scientists, with learning science to really evolve the ability for a person to learn in the context that matters to them. So that is a little bit of the history of LifeLab Studios and the Journey.do platform. We learned pretty quickly that it applies not just to classroom learners, it applies to anyone pursuing behavioral health change or any kind of behavioral change in their lives. They pretty quickly brought it out to the juvenile justice world and to the incarcerated folks and upon reentry. So we've been doing a lot of work in that sector as well. And it's only fairly recently, and you're one of the early adopters in the behavioral health space, bringing this to families. So kudos to you for doing that. And so we launched almost a year ago. We started with a Foundry pilot, and it's been going wonderfully.
Yeah, it's interesting. The thing that we learned in the pilot was even though the connection with a mentor is virtual, it's still a connection. And the coaches talk to the family members on a regular basis, and they're communicating, they're getting feedback on the things that they do. There's a full curriculum. I love the fact that I could transcribe all of my videos and all of the stuff that I had created for the in-person program or the video portion of the program, and that the Life Labs folks could just create curriculum out of it. And it was easy for me at that point. And then
Yeah.
the last thing that we really noticed was that the families really connect. And like groups started where people would say, "Are you the person that wrote that story about your son getting hit by the car or being in a car accident?" And I'd say, "Oh yeah, I wrote that." And I'd begin to say things like, "That was so touching." And when we had the same thing happen, and suddenly, while there one's in Indiana and one is in Idaho, now they're connected and they have that. And so, we found that our families do the exact same things that they did at Cedar in person.
Yeah. Well, kudos to you for really kind of pioneering the family program in a virtual setting and providing curriculum and ways to engage and support groups. And then taking the application, that Journey.do application, and converting everything over to it so that your families had a better experience, that there was science behind the way the curriculum was designed. And it was really cool to watch how the patented learning system, the connect, grow, apply, inspire process, which was invented at ASU through Life Lab Studios, was applied to your curriculum. And it took the evidence base that you had already curated and applied it to that technology. I think as a result, it's a more accessible experience for people. And it helps your coaches, your staff manage the family process, the growth process, the recovery process more effectively and efficiently as a result.
It's really been fun. It's really been interesting to watch how that process goes. And I so many of the listeners are thinking, yeah, this is great if my loved one would go to treatment. But what about us that our loved ones just refuse to go? Your thoughts on this kind of independent study, working in groups and virtual work with coach, as to the family changes that might be able to get someone into treatment, that someone might begin to recognize, hey, mom, dad, partner, you're different. Something's going on here.
Yeah, that's a great question, Mike. I've been involved with all kinds of populations, and so from the juvenile population to the older adult population to the incarcerated population to the probation population, all the research points to the fact that if families involved, it's better for everybody, especially the identified patient or the person in the family that seems to be the problem person, the person with the diagnosis, the substance use disorder patient, or the mental health patient, or both. Rather than taking the approach that we're only going to support with a family program people who come into treatment, we're going to support anyone, any family member that wants this information, wants this education, because eventually, it's in some cases, the family is still very much intact and still very much a part of the life of the person involved that we're talking about. But sometimes there's significant family disruption, and the person's been disowned or disconnected in some way from the family system. But I've worked with homeless shelters and programs that they have that as an explicit goal, as family, unification, or reconnection. If they're a parent, to, work on becoming an active part of the child's life again. And so that may or may not happen. But if the family's in recovery when that does happen, it's a much more likely to succeed kind of, event for that person, for that family member, or for the family members involved, than if they're not. And so, we start, and I think your curriculum does a good job to kind of lay in to this process of curating aligned motive. And so families that participate in the program, we really want to build a coaching connection. We really want to use MI to help, motivational interviewing to help family members identify their own goals for the program. So it's not my program, it's not your program, it's the family members' program. What do they want to accomplish? What do they want to achieve? And so curating that aligned motive really helps us start on the right foot. And then from there, once we have their goals identified and narrowed in on, then we can plan appropriately for their success. And that may or may not involve the identified patient. Their success may be just focusing on their needs and their ability to meet those needs, the skills that they need to instantiate in order for that to happen, and to have that motive be reflected in why they're doing the program. And so the evidence speaks for itself. You have people on there a year later who are still actively involved. And that's because you helped address some of their identified motives, some of their goals.
It's interesting. When I started writing my book, the very first words I wrote were, "Most people write books to tell people what to do and how to do it. This book is different. This book is intended to tell you why it's so hard to do all the things that other people tell you to do." And that's what, to me, that's what the app does. It's trauma informed and trauma integrated, and it helps families begin to recognize, "Holy cow, I have really." That's the thing that strikes me, is how often. I want to get to stories because that's a big part of it. They'll write in their stories how they realize how traumatized they have been through this process and how exhausted they are. And so that I think it goes beyond education and goes into a real insight level that may not get there through a weekend event of training. Because it's iterative. It's just they're going over it and over it at various times. So can you talk about stories and the importance of stories? That is my favorite part of the whole deal.
Yeah, I talked a little bit about the patented learning process, and that's really revolves around the idea of stories. And so I'll talk a little bit about that. The first thing that someone does when they encounter the curriculum is read someone else's story. And the story isn't just a nice thing that someone creates. It's really a story of application. So how have they used the information that they're learning to help their recovery? How have they used it in their own life? And it's often very inspiring how they've applied that material to their life to make their life better. It could be how they talk to someone, how they talk to their loved one, how they set up boundaries. It could be how they are reconciled. They understand the person more effectively. They can understand and talk about how they've applied that to their own life. So they stop talking necessarily about the identified patient. and start talking about their own experience, which is really pivotal. And the story does that naturally. It helps them make that transition without them even having to try to stop talking about the identified patient, because they talk about in the story their own experience. So you probably recall writing story criteria. So if the criteria is not met in the writing of the story, they get the story back. Just try again. And they get strength-based, trauma-informed feedback about their effort on that story. So that story is catalytic, not only in terms of what they write down and the process they go through, but also the feedback they get from trained professionals, from coaches, and from each other. So it becomes a way to connect people more effectively. It's also deeply emotional. And so family members are, like I said, they're not just writing nice stories. They're writing stories about hard things, difficult things. And it's a lot of times very emotional. So when I read someone else's story, it may resonate with me, it may trigger something in me that makes me emotional, and makes me connect to them on an emotional level. And so that's a very effective way to persuade someone. Maybe persuade is a wrong way to articulate it, but it really helps move someone from focus on you or the other person to focus on me. And that's what the ultimate goal of the family program is. So it also focuses on, so you connect to other stories and then you learn the information and then you write your own story of application. And so there are very specific skills that you have to write a story about. It makes you think about things that are important, details that are important in the application of those skills. It makes you use a critical thinking lens to think about the things that go into the story. It tests your tacit knowledge. Like, are you understanding the lesson that is being presented here? And it also is very validating. So it helps someone shift their identity from, in this case, a victim of the identified patient to someone who's empowered. So it helps them rewrite their own narrative. It helps them understand the power of narrative and that they have the ability to rewrite that narrative. So no longer are they being given a narrative to assume and act into, but they are creating their own narrative. And so that's a very important skill that's learned, not overtly, but covertly through the process of storytelling. And then if they write an excellent story that really resonates with the theme of the lesson and is a good application of that information into their own life, they inspire other people. So their stories get published and someone else can connect to it. So it's a very powerful process for someone to go through to connect to a story, to learn some information, to apply that information in a story that they write in a narrative that is their own, from their own words, and then they can possibly inspire other people.
The thing that I love is that when a family starts a module, the first thing that they access are the stories of the people who have gone through that module before them. And before they even read a word, they see, holy cow, these are pretty similar experiences to our experiences. And then when we opened up the feedback module, that people can now write back to them and say, thank you so much for that. But now we've got the social support aspect going on that goes beyond the value of the story, the personal value. But now it's kind of what 12-step was about, giving
That's
feedback.
right. When someone comments on your story, that it touched them, or that it moved them, or that it resonated with them, in important ways. They could see themselves in it. They learned something about their own situation. It empowered them. Then that's a bond that is formed that might take a lot of time to develop. And it's developed virtually. It's developed asynchronously. And so when you have a online support group in a synchronous fashion, like every Wednesday or every Sunday or whatever the day may be, they often come with already formed connections and say, "Aren't you the person who commented this? And that meant a lot to me, and here's why." And so they start with a history with each other in that group.
Yeah, it's been better, way better than I even imagined that it could be. And so that's, I appreciate you being willing to be on, and I really value so much of what you do, and I love work. I always love working with you, so it's all good. And so thank you. And I think that is there a fo how would you like them to get a hold of you? How would you like anyone who's interested in talking to you or accessing what you have? How would they access you?
Yeah, I'll give this to you, but I'll say that they can email me at steve@climb, KLYMB dot US, steve@climb.us, or steve@lifelabstudios.org. And I'll give you the information for the websites, and you can put those in the notes.
Have that all in there. Sounds great. Well, thank you, Steve. Always good to see you.
Thank you. Yeah, same here, Mike. I
Okay.
appreciate it.
Yeah, take care.